Have you ever listened to the pod and thought it would be awesome if Jen stopped being nerdy about movies for 60 seconds and talked about your business instead? Well, my friends, you're in luck. Watch with Jen is looking for sponsors. Do you own or run a theater, bookstore, film fest, website, school, physical media firm, pod, streaming channel, or small business that might like to advertise on Watch with Jen? Whether you're interested in sponsoring one episode or several, please reach out. You can get a hold of me at contact@filmintuition.com. Thanks so much. Hey, this is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. We're back from our short spring hiatus this week with a very special conversation featuring my friend and occasional co-host, the wonderful Senior Vice President of The Blacklist, Kate Hagen. And joining us today are two of our favorite women and returning guests in the form of the fabulous writer-director, cinephile, and retired professor, Allison Anders, and her incredibly in-demand music supervisor daughter, Tiffany Anders. Allison, of course, is the great filmmaker behind such contemporary classics as Gas Food Lodging, Mi Vida Loca, Grace of My Heart, and Things Behind the Sun. And Tiffany Anders is the tastemaker and music supervisor behind Reservation Dogs, Pen 15, and Beef. Passionate about music, especially rock and its intersection with film, they're here today to tell us all about the upcoming triumphant return of their beloved early-aught LA-based music festival, Don't Knock the Rock, which showcases hard-to-see and overlooked music documentaries and rock classics, and boasts masterclasses, special guests, discussions with filmmakers, and more. This year's festival is particularly exciting because it has both an in-person component at the American Cinematheque Los Feliz 3, which runs from May 23 to May 27, and a streaming festival hosted by Cineville.com from May 23 to July 31st that everyone can access. Kate and I can't wait to hear more about both of these things. So let's dive in. Ladies, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
Great.
Wonderful. Great to be here.
We're tired.
You're tired. Yeah, you guys are working so hard. Everyone needs to follow the Instagram. I love knowing what's going on, the cool videos you guys are posting. Yeah. Tiffany, are you behind the website? Is that your baby? Yes.
Yeah.
A lot of work.
I had to make a website for my music supervision earlier this year. So I had a little bit of knowing how to do it, but it's been a learning process. And yeah, I've been doing a lot of that. All of the promotional stuff and everything I've been on top of doing.
Wow. Well, I've been impressed by all of it. I love seeing the photos and the videos, and it kind of made me think, should I fly out? Should I go? Like, I want to see this festival. Yeah.
Yay, it's working.
You could be here, Jen. You could join
us. It's like I was just here a month ago, but need to come back. Yes.
I loved going through all the archive of photos on the website from Don't Knock the Rock's past. And even a couple people that, like, at one point I knew, like, Sonic Youth came through, but then I was reminded that Sonic Youth came through. But I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves. Maybe a great place to start is to talk about the first Don't Knock the Rock festival and how it came to be.
Well, incredibly, I mean, it was 2003. It was my first year teaching at UC Santa Barbara, and I created a class on rock and roll movies called Don't Knock the Rock. Yeah. And so Tiffany was living in New York and was anxious to come back. She had lived there for a while. I don't know, 10 years?
No, 5 years.
It felt long. It felt twice as long. So she was coming back to the West Coast, and I said, hey, I'm thinking of starting this festival. would you do it with me? And you could book the bands and we could have bands and movies. Now, I've been to a festival like this in England and in Sheffield, and it no longer exists, but it was really great. And they had played some of my music films. And so I loved it so much. I thought, oh, this is fantastic, you know. And they had like a rock and roll, Sheffield Rock and Roll Museum there at the time, which had like, you know, Human League and Pulp. And, you know? So it was great, you know. And I just, and then that film, that festival ended, and I was anxious to extend my class because it was so much fun doing it. And so Tiffany jumped in, and that very first year we were at ArcLight, and it was a great location for us. It wasn't a great theater for, I mean, It's hard to say it's not a great theater because it was a fantastic theater, but it wasn't so great for us, but we didn't know that yet.
Yeah.
We also shot really high.
Well, you gotta aim high, right?
I mean, I look at the stuff when I was doing the archive page. I was like, oh my God, we really went for it. I mean, there were teen band contests. There were Dusty Springfield lookalike contests.
Oh, fun.
I mean, even Sonic Youth within itself was pretty insane because I had never booked shows. I mean, besides like booking my own gigs, which was hard enough for me to do on my own as a musician. Mm-hmm. I had no idea how to promote a show, like a concert like that. So, you know, we reach out to Thurston and he's like, oh, that sounds fun. Yeah, sure. And then it's like, oh, there's management and then there's a venue and then we didn't have any money. It's not like we had we didn't have sponsor. I mean, we ended up getting sponsorship, but it was mostly it wasn't cash sponsorship. It was just like, we'll lend you some gear. We'll give you some t-shirts. We'll, you know, we didn't really, the only cash sponsorship I think we had, which was not a lot, was BMI. I think it was like a little tiny bit, but it wouldn't have been enough to even cover, you know, three plane tickets for Sonic Youth, you know? And so Thurston had said, you know, if you can get us there, we're down. And that sounds so simple, but it's never simple, especially, I mean, no matter what kind of band it is, what level, but at their level, it really was not that simple. And, you know, I ended up having things like having my friends do like setting up their writer, like the snacks backstage, you know, and usually there's all sort of stuff that's, you know, like a Golden Voice or whatever, concert promoters have staff that, you know, they know how to do all this. But since we were doing it, we really had no clue. But part of what's great about it is that it ended up being, because we didn't really know what we were doing, we strived for stuff that was really big, you know, too big for us, really. And we had these amazing shows, like that show with Sonic Youth. I mean, we had this band Dead Meadow open, and I was just a fan of the band. And they came out from DC, and which is very special to me because one of the guys in the band just passed away, Billy, the bass player. So, and he was really instrumental in helping make that happen, you know, like, oh, that's cool. You want us to open for Sonic Youth, you know, just kind of blindly going out there and asking people to come out and play. That was a lot of work too, but
yeah,
it's a lot of work. This is always a lot of work, no matter how many times we've done it. It's just work.
Yeah,
I love it. I worked on a couple of film festivals when I first moved to Arizona. I was the grant writer, volunteer supervisor. I helped curate, did summaries. Kind of when you work a festival for the Scottsdale International, you're kind of a Jill of all trades. You find your helping out in every area. And it's a really good learning experience. And I was really touched listening to you, Allison, talk about your class, because I followed you for years. And one of the things I loved was when you would say what you were showing your students at Santa Barbara in this class, yeah. Because I was working for DVD Netflix and they had a pretty good library, and I would try to track down anything I could find. I remember seeing the Tammy show because you recommended it, and I think you guys played it at the festival. So are there movies that you remember introducing to people that, you know, struck a particular chord, kind of like with your students? That has to be so inspiring to watch a movie take, you know, take hold of an audience like that, that you love. Well,
yeah, it's funny because the Tammy show was interesting because it had been one of my favorites since, well, I didn't see it when it came out because it barely came out. So almost nobody saw it when it came out, but it was, it played late nights on local TV networks. And so I discovered it in the 70s on TV. And so I was obsessed with this movie, as many of my friends were. And so the very first year, I was like, we got to get the Tammy show. So we got Quentin Tarantino had a print.
Oh, wow.
His print. And I had searched forever. I can find anybody. I could not find this filmmaker. And I get an email that said from, you know, I didn't know who from, you know, and he said, I see that you're playing the Tammy show, and I wonder if I could come. I directed it. And I was like,
oh, God.
He said, can you come? You can, we'll throw you a party. You can come. So just, you know, and I love sharing that movie with people. I think it still holds up geniusly. And he's just the most wonderful man. And really, he was 23 years old at the time when he made that, you know, quite like Michael Lindsay Hogg doing the same there in England at the time on Ready, Steady, Go. So, you know, these were young, very young guys making this material. So, you know, yes, there are so many films that it's funny. One of my former students will be presenting a film this year.
Oh, wow.
She and my former assistant both discovered and restored and rescued and made possible to the world. So Maya Smuckler, my former assistant, and KJ Reith, who now is at the Academy. So one's at the UCLA Film Archive and one's at the Academy. And that film is the Plastic Dome of Norma Jean, made by a woman filmmaker in the 60s. And Maya discovered the film, and then she and KJ rescued it and, you know, found the film and made it possible for people. So she was one of my students in the Don't Knock the Rock class, which is kind of great.
That's so cool. Full circle.
Yeah, totally.
That is a hot ticket for me. That movie is not easy to see. So LA, please go check out Plastic Dome of Norma Jean if you're around. I think it's played TCM like one time ever, and then the print, and that's about it, folks.
That's right. And it's Sam Waterston. How much do we miss him from Law and Order? You know, he's gone now, but he's playing a drummer in a garage band in this movie. So, he's cute as hell.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of cute boys in the movie for sure.
Yeah.
And Norma Jean herself. But yeah, I mean, Tiffany, there's loads of films, I mean, that Tiffany could talk about too, that, you know, that Tiffany also, I mean, look, after the first year, we were both curating the movies. I mean, you know, she wasn't just working on the music anymore, because we just started to understand what we were putting out there for people and who the audience was. But she introduced me to tons of stuff. She still does. You know, I'll be like, I don't know who Felt is, you know, or, you know, I don't know that band. How did I miss that? You know, but she'll introduce me to stuff I don't know about, you know, and then I'll sometimes really make it tedious for her with stuff that I still really, really love.
I wanted to ask specifically, Tiffany, about the Dori Previn documentary. I know she's been a personal hero of yours, and I believe you started a blog inspired by her. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, I did. I mean, it's funny, you know, I worked at Amoeba Records, Amoeba Music, and I heard somebody was playing this one of her songs over the in the store. And I just was like, I was like restocking things and I was like, what is this? Oh my God, this song is so hilarious and so good. And so I went up to the info desk where they would put what they were playing in the store up there. And I was like, it was a compilation that Steve Mackey from Pulp and Jarvis Cocker had put together of just like songs that they liked. And then I just started digging into her records, you know, and like looking for her records. And so it kind of inspired this idea that I wanted to do kind of outsider female musicians of that time period. And because Dori Previn is so unique, and especially for that time, in the way that she approached music and songwriting and, you know, in this very confessional, dark humor sort of way, you know, it inspired a lot in me, you know. And I ended up, I did write a blog. I had a blog for a little while that kind of featured these outsider female artists. And then I ended up interviewing Jarvis Cocker on Dori Previn, which was really amazing. And then he gave me some interviews with her from the BBC. Like he sent me like recordings of, of interviews with her. So then I approached Shindig magazine and I said, hey, I want to write this thing about Dori Previn. Can I do it? I had these really amazing interviews and I interviewed Jarvis Cocker about her and they were like, sure. So I wrote an article on her. The filmmakers of the Dori Previn documentary are also as obsessed as I am, particularly Julia Greenberg, who like had this whole, she would do Dori Previn songs. She had a whole Dori Previn night in New York and she met Dori Previn before she died. So she's a mega fan and they knew that I was a mega fan and they reached out to me to help with clearing the music for the film, which I, you know, agreed to happily do for them. And the documentary is kind of mind-blowingly fantastic because there's surprisingly so much footage of her and she's such a good interview because she's so intelligent and so unique and has so much insight. And her interviews that exist, you know, on camera are just phenomenal. So they really did a great job of making that documentary about one of my heroes.
Yeah, and their style in, you know, I don't think I ever understood, because we think of Dori Previn, we think of that, you know, white afro, you know, and the whole, the glasses and everything. But she was like, you know, quite stylish. I mean, that's stylish too, like no other at the time. Yes, very. And I think that maybe even Julie Christie took a few her look. But at that time, but she also in the 60s, she was just so chic and glamorous, you know, in those early days of with Dori Previn and even a little bit before that, you know. So she's interesting for us too, because this festival has our in-person in particular is very LA-centric. this year. And it just kind of worked out like that, but we're happy about it because we're still very LA history fanatics. And so, you know, Dory really made her work here for the most part, even though she wasn't from here. She came out and, you know, worked for the studios, and then her, you know, 70s singer-songwriter career was here as well.
Yeah.
Tiffany, on Mother's Day, you put up a really cool old photo of your mom listening to Goat's Head Soup. And Allison, we know that your dog is named Charlie Watts. And I know you guys share this passion for music, and I love that. Kate and I are both close to our moms. And so I was just wondering, your history together with Rolling Stones, like a first bond, like, you know, what musical bands, what memories do you have that maybe you wanted to reach back and like, oh, we loved this when you were young, Tiffany, so let's put it in the festival, anything like that?
Well, you know, my mom was constantly playing music when I was a kid. I mean, her biggest love is the Beatles.
Yes. Oh, we need to ask about that.
And yes. I might be more Stones than Beatles. So
I would say so.
Diverge there a little bit.
This is your biggest feud as mother and daughter, Stones or Beatles.
Exactly. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, she was listening to a lot of X when I was a kid, a lot of LA punk bands.
Yeah.
So, that's so cool.
When she was playing X records, I think I was really just so taken by X scene, which I still am. Mm-hmm. I'm still just like, she's like a Dory Previn to me. It's like total righteous female hero, like not following the rules that have been put in place by society at all. Like, so I really liked her. I just immediately was taken with her when I was a kid, when you were playing those records, Mom, and seeing her.
That was the first thing I thought of was X. And yeah, you just coming to love Xene so much.
I just loved X. I mean, it makes sense too, because I loved Pippi Longstocking. So
I know.
Trend here.
I did too. My gosh.
There's a trend. I liked these kind of women that were just like, fuck you.
Yeah.
I'd say that was the first thing. And then we like, you know, I went through a big Red Cross phase, and my mom had been friends with them and then started working with them. And then Dinosaur Jr.
Yes.
That was kind of our first kind of almost collaboration on something. Yes. Because
I love that story so much about calling.
Yeah, you went to go see them, and I had been seeing in magazines and stuff pictures of Jay, and I thought he was really cute. I remember that. And I was like 14. So, of course, I don't think I admitted that I thought he was. But then you got the record. I think you got the record, Mom, from SST. And then I couldn't stop listening. I mean, then it was just like, I'm totally into Dinosaur Jr. Still am.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started saying, no, you got to get him to be in the movie, you got to get him to do your film scores, you gotta like,
yeah.
But you reminded me also that you said that he I have totally forgotten that he said he would like a role in the movie in Gas Food Live.
Yeah.
That's right, because you and Tiffany, or he and Tiffany, have a scene. Yeah,
yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, he had said, because at the time Lou Barlow had just left the band. So I think you had asked him, Mom, if the band would play in a club, like play in a club scene, which I really wanted to happen. The funniest part of it is, I don't think we even really knew that Gas Food Lodging was actually going to happen.
Oh. Mm.
We just called him up and we're like, hey.
And she's and like then, 16 at the time.
Yeah, I think I was like 15, maybe.
Yeah, maybe so.
And then I remember him saying, I don't really have a band right now, but I'm interested in acting.
That's right. And I've cast him 3 times since. He was almost in Mi Vida Loca, too.
Yeah, oh, man. I think he's a little bummed that he wasn't in Mi Vida Loca.
Yeah. He was going to buy drugs. Thing. Yeah.
How full circle that you guys are all still friends. And then to the mm-hmm. Red Cross conversation, the fact that you guys get yes. to host the premiere of the Red Cross documentary, which I'm sure is extremely meaningful as people who loved LA and love the punk scene here particularly.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's great that LA is so featured, you know, in Red Cross and, a very specific part of Hollywood, you know, of LA being Hawthorne, you know, so, and South Bay and all of that area, you know, that people don't think about much. And so that's fascinating in that documentary. And also Swamp Dog gets his pool painted, even though he's not from LA. He's getting his pool painted in the valley. So,
Really it counts. Yeah.
He's here now. Yeah. So he's here. He's LA.
And all roads lead back to the valley, I feel right. like, eventually.
Oh, my God. Yeah. It's a great thing about the Swamp Dog movie, too, is that, you know, LA forgets because it can be so isolating and everything is so sprawling and you forget that all these amazing creative people just are living right under your nose right here, you know? So with Swamp Dog, it's like, he has this incredible story, incredible history. And there he is just living in the valley, like this little gold mine of like talent and history. And, you know, just all this stuff that we take for granted when we're from LA or if we live in LA, that these people all, you know, that so many creative people come out here and live here, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And this year's lineup has so many great female filmmakers featured. I was wondering if you guys wanted to talk about that and some of the films and directors that you're having this year.
Yeah, I actually think we have more female directors this year than men.
We might.
Wow. And then Somebody. All of Saturday.
Yep.
Wow.
And then Dori Previn.
Yeah. So I think we might have more female directors. So the Saturday lineup was actually her idea of women directors. So we have Ava DuVernay's very first film, which we also had at Don't Knock the Rock, like in 2008. So it's an amazing movie about a very vibrant, diverse hip hop scene at the beginning of it in LA. So again, it's LA. She's from here.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was always, for both of us, it's just interesting because it's interesting for so many reasons, but it's also interesting how the seeds that need to be protected of an arts movement, music, film, are, you know, that's where everything's open. You know, women get a fair shot, you know, everybody gets a shot, every kind of thing, expression of music or film has a place. And then commerce starts and it's all male driven and it's aggressive. And that's what happened with punk rock here. You know, it was the most amazing, vibrant scene in LA. And then it just became hardcore punk. And this is what happened with the hip hop scene as well, you know, where there was this vibrancy and then it became gangster rap, you know, and it that kind of took over. But this is before that. This is this beautiful collection of musicians. And Tiffany can tell you more about where the place was. And
Yeah, I mean, it's what's crazy about it is that it was in Leimert Park at a health food store.
Oh, wow.
And her footage is insane because the health, it was at a health food store or a health food restaurant?
Both. Yeah, it was like a cafe and
cafe. Yeah. So it's packed. I mean, just packed to the brim and really raucous, you know, like people are like jumping up and down and all these different MCs. Like my mom said, I mean, there were women MCs up there. There were, you know, a chemist, you know, it was
white guy,
white guys and
Mexican guys.
Yeah. So like, and it was like happening, like very happening. So it's just very interesting. And I think in the trailer, it's great because it starts out like with this guy saying, yeah, there was NWA and all that. And, but we had this other thing going on, like, you know, like,
yeah.
Like, you know, everybody focuses on that, which I love. I mean, I love, I love NWA, love it to death. But yeah, like there was this whole other happening in LA hip hop in the 90s. So.
And it was a woman on the health food store, The Good Life, it was called.
Yeah.
And she was an older woman. African-American woman, and she allowed this open mic night to happen, plus videotaped it, thank God.
Yeah. And
she said, there are no drugs and alcohol, no cursing.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
So it's amazing because the edge is still all there within the confines, you know, and that's... Yeah. That's what's brilliant is that people think that creativity is just this wild kind of thing, but these parameters actually make for a more vibrant creativity.
Thinking outside the box.
Yeah. And Ava's in the film, but she also was one of the, she had a band.
Oh my gosh.
And they were pushing the edge. With their songs.
Her whole second life.
They're the ones that did the power of the P, if I'm not mistaken. The woman was starting to go, the proprietor was like, all right.
2 PG-13 for us. Thank you so much. That's pretty hard to see too, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. So y'all, please go see that. Also, I'm always so fascinated by seeing filmmakers' early work and first films and them sort of figuring it out and finding their voice. So, yeah, put that on your schedule for Don't Knock the Rock, too, y'all.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. That's a great, great one. So great. And then we have Susan Seidelman's a double feature of, you know, Smithereens and Desperately Seeking Susan.
Amazing. Yeah. I would love to see those on the big screen. My gosh.
Yeah,
what a delight. I feel like you and Susan are very much cut from the same cloth, Allison, in terms of the way you use music in your films, the kind of worlds you came up in, even though it's New York, LA, and truly just like kicking some walls down when nobody else was in the independent scene in the 80s.
I swear she is the most kindred to me of all filmmakers, I think.
You know, I love that.
Because we both... I mean, it's interesting. Not only were we both sort of, we were on the periphery, as she says, of these punk scenes. You know, she was on the periphery, and I feel like I was on the periphery, too. It's and I said, I kind of hung back a little bit, and she says, well, that's what we do, right? That's, as filmmakers, you kind of are observant.
Yep.
So you do stand back. So, but, you know, she's got like, you know, she, one of the things that she and I both do is this mix of like musicians with actors. So, you know, it's fascinating to watch that she's got Susan Berman in Smithereens, who is an actress and really has that craft with Richard Hell, who this is a musician. And then she does it again in Desperately Seeking Susan with Rosanna, who, while she was new, you know, Rosanna was fairly new at the time, she still had her craft down. And, you know, and then there's Madonna with no craft, you know, that's just, and putting them together is just so exquisite. Like watching Madonna again in this movie and watching them together, they're not in that many scenes together, but the fact that they're together in the same movie, and it's just beautiful. And I was telling her that, I watched Rosanna. She says, what I like is that the musicians come with a persona. And I go, this is it. They're performers. They come with a persona. And I said, that's it. And sometimes you want that persona and sometimes you want them to let go of it a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I said, but then you pair them with an actor and it's fantastic because they'll give each other like the actor will get a little looseness from the musician, and the musician will get structure from the actor. And I said, I watched Rosanna turn John Taylor into an actor. John Taylor from Duran Duran. He just, in Sugartown, when we were rehearsing, she just, without him realizing it, she's reading the lines, getting him up on his feet. She just stood up and he followed her. And then she walked around him, and then he walked around her, and then she turned her back on him and he starts walking after her to doing the lines. And I was like, she just turned this guy into an actor just doing it, you know? And it was just, it's beautiful to watch their performances again. So I'm excited for everybody to see both of these films together and be able to talk about them both, you know?
I loved listening to that because I feel like everybody just talks about Madonna when it comes to Desperately Seeking Susan. And I mean, the entire cast is great. You know, I love the sister-in-law. I love all of the different characters, the supporting players. But I feel like Rosanna brings so much to the movie. And like, she's the one, the heart. Her scenes with Aidan Quinn are amazing. And yeah, the way she sparks with people. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting because she talks about Susan, about because I did a pre-taped interview with her for afterwards. But, you know, she really found Aidan Quinn like very early on. But she went out to everybody and they were like, oh, you know, well, the two women are the lead, so I don't want to do that part, you know, because I felt, you know, and she says, now, if we had waited 2 years, we wouldn't have been able to get Aidan Quinn either.
That's true.
Interesting that they recognize that, no, the parts are the women's. They're the leads, you know. There's no male lead here, you know. But there's great Tiffany, too, when you see it again. It's so amazing because she had Lust for Life before anybody.
Oh, my God.
Iggy Pop song, you know. So before anybody had that, you know. And she's got some great. But she also uses music ironically and for the character. Like, she has Rosanna in her lifestyle, like, you know, like a party at her house that and Carly Simon's Belong to Me is playing.
Speaking of some really incredible needle drops, Tiffany, I messaged this to you on Instagram, but you ruined my life at many opportunities last season of Reservation Dogs. Some of those needle drops were like a missile directly to my heart, particularly the George Jones version of Let the Circle Be Unbroken. And I just wanted, first of all, to congratulate you on a couple of magnificent years of music supervisions, whether it's Reservation Dogs, Beef, Pen 15, The Other Black Girl, like, dude, you've been crushing it. And like, let us say so. but I'm wondering, you know, when you're watching a movie as a music supervisor, even something like Desperately Seeking Susan that you've seen before, like, how does that start to get the gears turning in terms of, you know, current projects you're working on? Do you have like a mental file of like, oh, I love that, I'm going to use that for something later too?
Yeah. I mean, that definitely happens. I definitely make the mental files of of what I want to use. Constantly, because when I'm on something, I mean, even driving in the car and stuff, I'm like, oh, wait, I need to, I'll Shazam it so that I have it, mm-hmm. so that I remember to add it, you know. But yeah, with the festival, it's very interesting because a lot of the stuff that we like to book or curate is outsider kind of things. So it definitely helps put it on the radar for me for somewhere, you know, that I might want to use. I mean, God, I would be so thrilled if I could use a Dori Previn song in something someday.
And nobody has, right? Nobody has.
No, I mean,
it's because it's going to be you, Tiffany. That's what I'm hearing here. Yeah.
Gotta be me. I mean, besides the songs that she wrote, like
exactly, for
Valley of the Dolls,
you're going to get from me.
Yeah, I feel like, it would be a dream to be able to use something of Dori Previn's. And yeah, I mean, definitely for me, it's exciting to watch something like Desperately Seeking Susan, a narrative, because it is so full, jam-packed with music. And I'm always paying attention to how music is being used in narrative things because it's so... it's fascinating to me. So, yeah.
Yeah. I know you worked at Amoeba. This is a little aside, but since you guys are LA girls and have fabulous taste, I mean, we should definitely reward all of the LA people. What are your favorite LA record shops? Like, you know, I make a list every time I go bookshops, record shops, I need to go. And then I make my friend Rob Belushi, like, mail them home to me because I can't fit them in my suitcase. But so yeah, where do I have to hit next?
Yeah. Well, I love Amoeba. I actually love Amoeba because I love the way that it's set. I mean, I love the one guy behind a counter, you know, those kinds of record stores too. But yeah. What I love about Amoeba is that there's so many people that you can talk to there that are crazy knowledgeable.
Yes.
So
they had to take the knowledge. They had to do like, you know, like the taxi drivers in London where they have to learn the knowledge.
Yeah.
To drive the city. They had to have the knowledge. They had the knowledge test.
Yeah. You were given a test of like what genre thing, you know, they give you a stack of CDs with just the spines and you'd have to say where they belonged, what section they belonged in. And I remember getting stuck on Django Reinhardt and I was like, folk? And she was like, I'm going to let you pass on that one because it is a fine line.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there was something else too. I think I put Nina Simone in Soul and they were like, no, that is jazz.
Oh, wow.
Like they got really like, how could you get that wrong? But I like going there because it is a lot of people who have knowledge and they can recommend stuff, you know? And it's funny because even doing my job, you know, I'll be on Spotify. If I need to find some 90s singer songwriter and I'm on Spotify, and this is what always happens is you're like, okay, Paula Cole. And then they'll go, you know, you look in the similar artists.
Yes.
And then you get trapped. I start to feel trapped. And then I'm like, okay, now Natalie Merchant. Okay, now what's, and I'm like, this isn't correct. Like, this isn't really telling me what I'm really looking for. And really, I just need to go to a record store and browse and talk to people about, you know, what they are, you know, what they think, you know, if they have a suggestion or, you know, stuff like that. So I do like Amoeba for that, but I love Gimme Gimme Records in Highland Park too. I love Permanent Records just because they have shows there and a bar, and they've combined all things into one, which is kind of amazing. So
very cool.
Those two are good ones.
I like Freak Beat Out in the Valley.
Okay.
And I really loved Rhino when it was in Claremont. You know, I would go down there now and then with my granddaughter. But they've moved now to Montclair. So Claremont and Montclair, they're both right next to each other.
That's funny.
But and it's still great. It's just it was so nice when it was there in the village there in Claremont. But I like that too. Although, you know, to have that kind of personal attention, I think it's kind of rare now, you know, like
that's true.
Yeah, MIPA, they really have the customer service thing locked down.
Yeah.
And really amazing, knowledgeable, great, eccentric people who work there, you know.
In the background of both Allison and Tiffany Zooms, there are massive cubes of vinyl that you guys cannot see, but they are indeed the experts we were looking for. Do y'all have like a single holy grail record that you're still searching for after all these years that's been a little bit unattainable?
That's not nice.
Mom, you go.
Well, I would love to have the bootleg that I bought when I was 15 in Nevada of Beatles. It was a Beatles bootleg and it was all live recordings. And I didn't appreciate it at the time because it was just girls screaming and them trying to play at a stadium or whatever. And it was just like a black album cover with some fuzzy black and white pictures of them. So I'd love to find that again, although I'm sure everything has already been archived and processed, but it would be nice to have that.
Yeah.
And I did search for years for this song that I recommended on the TCM social media. I recommended this movie, Penelope, which played earlier this month.
I love that movie. Yeah.
Yeah. So good. And so Natalie Wood sings that song, The Sun is Great. And I finally found the 45 at a yard sale when we lived at UCLA student housing. And I couldn't believe it because I looked forever for it. And then later, Tiffany, working at her first record store when she was 14, Rockaway Records, she found me the album of Gail Garnett singing that song. So I already do have all of that now. And I have Natalie Wood singing it too. But I think that one Beatles would be great for me.
Gosh, I don't know. I feel like there's so many.
Yeah.
But I also just am so on top of purchasing things that I want immediately.
Before it goes away.
Like I'll go on Discogs and look for stuff that I want. So I don't know if there's anything still outstanding.
Okay.
I don't have any like, you know, $1,000 album, you know, I don't really like have anything that's like that.
Gotcha.
I am not allowed to go on discogs.com. Every time I go there, I'm just like, Kate, don't spend this money. One of mine is the Japanese pressing of the Valley Girl soundtrack because it's more complete than any of the US editions.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But it's like, I think the last time I looked, it was like $400. So I was like, well, I do love that we all have just massive stacks of physical media behind us.
Yeah. So true.
Incredibly important.
And I mean, physical media, but also this year you guys have a streaming component to the festival. So what can you tell us about that? It's with Cineville.
Yeah. You know, Cineville had come to us about curating a streaming festival for their site. And my mother had worked with Carl, he was the producer on her films, Gas Food Lodging, Mi Vida Loca. And we'd always kind of wanted to do something like this. We just didn't know how to do it. And the thing that I liked about it being a streaming festival is that not only would we get an opportunity to show some things that we've had previously, but we'd also be able to shine a light on things we hadn't or things that got lost. And bring it all together in one place. And when the pandemic had started, James Ponsult and I had started this film noir group where we'd watch a couple of noir movies and then we'd, and it's still going. We're still doing it.
I love that. I had a movie club too in the pandemic. It's great.
Yeah. So when I thought about the streaming festival, I was like, you know, it's hard when people have to subscribe to something. It's like, oh, I'm not going to pay for another subscription. I can just track it down on Amazon or YouTube or, you know. So I just thought this kind of is great because we can present it as like a movie club, you know, like we can put these all together. We can do Q&As. We can do panels. These filmmakers can talk about their work. They can answer. And then the audience members can join up on a Zoom and ask questions, you know. So I just thought it would be really great for us to be able to present these movies to an audience that really will appreciate them and do it more in an engaging way.
Yeah, and some of them are films that, you know, I mean, there's so much stuff that is not streaming.
Yes.
There's just so much. I mean, my films are not streaming, and they could be. Some of them could be. But, you know, you can buy them. You can rent them on Amazon, Gas, Food, Lodging, or Grace of My Heart. But you can't, but they're not streaming anywhere. You know, they're not on. They're not on Netflix or anywhere like that. So those have, you know, those have people in them that are actors of note.
Yes.
But if you've got some outsider musician, you know, and it's not straight, you know, it's, you know, chances are good you're not going to find this film, you know. I mean, maybe you're going to find it on a DVD or something, but chances are pretty good you're not going to find it anywhere else. So we're thrilled about that because there's a lot of these that are not, you know, they're just not readily accessible. And then we have some by, like we contacted Oscilloscope. We were looking for one film and then we ended up getting six. It was a long process, I must say. It took us a while, but we did get a whole collection of films, and they were down for it from the beginning. Yeah. But they were, you know, and then we were like, okay. And then once you do the first deal, then you can do the rest of them very easily. But we did that, and we're really excited about those movies. And Factory 25, we also have movies from them, and we have movies from Magnolia and a couple other places, but we're happy about those places that care so much about particular kinds of music films, you know, so that's, we can shine a light on them too, you know, which is nice because, you know, they do such a good job with these movies, and they're picking up things that are not necessarily going to be huge hits for, you know, they're not going to be for the masses, you know, they're going to be for people that where they need to be curated, you know, they're going to be for people who care about this kind of thing.
Yeah.
think I remember you guys telling me that you screened an MC5 doc that then like kind of fell into obscurity. And I'm sure too that there have been other films throughout the run of the festival. It's like, well, folks, I hope you saw it and don't knock the rock, because it really hasn't come back around since Music Licensing has hamstrung so many things. It makes me so, so sad. Like, just clear the rights, guys, please.
Yeah. Well, the MC5 was particularly upsetting because that was our first opener of our first festival.
Yeah, first year.
And we tracked it down and we, you know, convinced the filmmakers and they came to LA and it was the most marvelous documentary. It really was. It was so spectacular and so fun and so vibrant. And it just sucks what ended up, that it still is not seen the way that we saw it. So there were a number of those. After a while, after that year, people were definitely saying that, like, I better go to Don't Knock the Rock because I might not be able to see this ever again. Because nobody else was showing these movies. Yeah. And I have to say that over the years, we've seen people try to do what we do. I'm not bragging, but I guess I am kind of.
As well you should.
Because they just think, oh, we'll just throw a bunch of music films in there. You know, at big festivals, they'll try to do this, you know, and then they just don't, they don't have a context for what they're showing, you know, or they don't know the audience or, you know.
Yeah,
so I do feel pleased about that.
I like also that you guys have those panels and master classes. So is there anything this year you want to talk about that you have lined up for that?
Well, we're going to do one on music supervision. So
very cool.
Will definitely be one. And then we're probably going to do a master class on making a music documentary. So we'll have filmmaker documentarians, music documentarians talk about that. I know from being a music supervisor and then also helping out on some of these music documentaries where there's music clearance involved, you know, it's a whole thing that I think most filmmakers don't really, I mean, we've seen it over and over again at our festival where these filmmakers aren't quite aware of what goes in the costs and what goes into clearing music. So I think that's something that is going to be really interesting and useful to people that want to make these movies, you know? And I'm really hoping that we're going to have a Grace in My Heart music panel.
Oh my god,
that would be wonderful.
The making of the music for Grace in My Heart.
My favorite.
Something that I've always wanted to do, because I wrote a song for the film and I remember the whole experience of recording the song, which was so fun.
Which one was
so incredible? Absence Makes the Heart Grow Fonder.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's her and Boyd Rice, and it's they recorded in Studio A at Capitol Records, and
The whole making is just it was kind of unlike anything else, because at the time that it happened, I mean, I think it happened before people started really making songs for movies before they even shot them, right? Mm-hmm. Weren't we doing exactly. Before you shot?
Yeah, I had to do everything before we shot.
Wow.
And then also, you know, what was amazing, like this is the typical thing that would happen, is that Tiffany and Boyd are in the recording studio and they're studio musicians that Larry Klein, the producer, has brought in, the music producer. And I don't know who these people are. This is before the Wrecking Crew documentary. Nobody knew who these people were.
Oh. And
there's this guy standing there with a stand-up bass. And so, you know, Tiffany and Boyd and I are talking about, this is like a Lee Hazelwood, Nancy Sinatra type song. And the bass player starts doing the running bass line for "These Boots Are Made for Walking." And we realized,
oh my gosh.
Oh my God, that's the guy who did all the Lee and Nancy and Lee songs that Larry doesn't even mention. Oh yeah.
Like, do you guys know this?
Basically. Yeah. Like, same thing happened with Jay Maskus, where
this was good.
Where the you know, he loved having these studio musicians. He just loved it. He thought it was hilarious. He had these backup singers that he loved having in there, guys and girls, you know, and he loved having that. But he also had a theremin player, and the theremin player was very proud of the fact that he had done the theme song to My Favorite Martian.
Okay.
Was that the name of the show? Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so he was very excited that he did that theme song with the, and then, but then when they started to play the song, he's feeling a Beach Boys vibe. And he goes, "Oh, is this supposed to sound like the Beach Boys?" He says, "I did a song with them. I'm good, good. like vibration."
Oh my God. I'm a huge Beach Boys person. Yeah.
So he was that theremin player to play.
Oh my goodness. Sort of
boys sounding.
And backup singers that had been backup singers on Beach Boys records.
That's right. That's right.
The backup singers on Jay Maskus's Beach Boys sounding as song.
Yeah.
It sound like the Beach Boys.
So yeah, even if we don't get the film to stream, I think we got to do that masterclass.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, we're trying to get the movie right now so we can have it on the streamer, but we got to do the masterclass.
Yeah, we got to do
absolutely.
It.
Yeah. You guys always have the best stories. You're always like, "Oh, by the way, when I ended up with my 45 from Jackie Onassis, no problem." Oh, no, that's why I love talking to you guys. You're always like, you have so many cool constellation points, both in movies and music. And I feel like many people have one or the other, but you guys get to straddle both worlds in such a cool way.
Yes. And there's something coming up with Mi Vida Loca, another screening of it. Is it in
June? Yeah. So it's the 30th anniversary. LA Conservancy is, you know, host every year their last remaining seats. So that's going to be amazing, you know, because that's going to be, it's at one of the old, you know, movie palaces downtown. And yeah, it's just going to be, it's going to be great, you know, and a lot of the cast will be there and, you know, just some fun. There'll be lowriders down the boulevard.
Yeah.
And that's June 15th.
Okay.
At, LA Conservancy, people can buy tickets. There's still a few left, not many, but there's still some. And then, yeah, there's just some fun people, you know, like people will be there that are like, you know, some of the actors from Mayans, you know, the TV show.
Cool.
And so that in particular, you know, the Chicano community is going to have a field day.
You directed some Mayans, right?
Yeah. I did a couple of those. Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
We'll see you guys there. I'm looking forward to it. Can't wait to weep in public to Mi Vida Loca. Love it. Yeah.
That's going to be fun.
Yes. And Tiffany, what do you have going on? What are you working on? You always have so much going on.
I'm working on a series right now. I don't think I can say anything.
Oh, no problem. I don't want to get you in trouble.
Yeah, I've got a series that I'm very excited to be working on.
Okay.
It's cool. Really fun. But I'm hoping that I get some other stuff rolling in. It's been a little rough after the strikes.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's such a strange time. I feel like especially TV has been so hard hit, like getting all of those machines gearing back up and then seeing what's going to happen with IATSE this summer. I keep hearing the mantra "survive till 25" for industry friends. I'm like, yeah, but people have rent to pay and they need to eat. Also, there's got to be a better way, folks. Yeah,
it's crazy.
It benefits, you know, it benefits the workers, but nothing benefits the greed at the top.
No. Like,
I see it happen every time.
Yep.
Yeah.
Strikes just help them not spend a dime, you know, on content, and they figure out how to do it. And now we've got AI, so they can really figure out
how to play the game. Yeah.
No, thank you is what I would like to say to that.
I'm not anti-strike, but you got to be careful. You know, you got to be careful. I mean, you get your gains, but, you know, they're going to win too. You know, they're always going to win.
That was always my sort of attitude last summer, was like, yes, let's get the fair and equitable deal. But unfortunately, I know that the studios are going to be so punitive on the other side of this, because they've been in so embarrassed. And it's just so frustrating to see all the working people in the industry who become caught in that crossfire, when in fact, we could just be making good stuff all the time and employ some people. Yeah, radical concept. Yeah.
I know.
We should end on one high point after the strike talk. So, ladies, favorite music docs or rock movies? You have like one or two recommendations you want to shout out?
I have to say, I think Dig is probably one of my favorite rock docs.
I just saw it for the first time because of Don't Knock the Rock. Like, I looked it up. My friend had the movie, and oh my gosh, the line, you know, like, motherfucker broke my fucking sitar. That was, I was saying that all week. Yeah. It was just so much fun. Yes.
So I mean, it's really good.
Yeah.
It's a really good one. Yeah. So for me, I think that's one of my favorite rock docs. I think, I think she managed to capture something very interesting, because, you know, I was on the periphery of, I just moved back to LA, so I kind of knew those Brian Jonestown Massacre guys.
Okay.
But I didn't get I wasn't that involved in their scene, and I didn't really care. I mean, I know some of those characters in the movie, but she just like managed to, tell a story that is so like phenomenally insightful into the rock and roll world. And, you know, it's just funny that it's like, when I watch it, I'm like, I can't believe that was under my nose and I wasn't paying attention. Mm. You know, that's how it is for me. It's like, wow, she really like tore it wide open. So I really love that documentary. It's one of my favorite rock documentaries.
And that the one that we're showing is the one that was shown at Sundance. So it's the anniversary, and it's got more footage. It's got other additional footage and stuff like that. So that'll be cool. And, you know, I mean, favorite... One of my favorites that we're showing, or just in general,
Either way. Yeah.
Well, in general, I mean, you don't beat A Hard Day's Night. I mean, that should be the holy grail for everybody.
Yeah.
It's really spectacular. Although I have to say that recently we saw Let It Be, which of course now, you know, but we saw it at the El Capitan, and, you know, I had seen Let It Be when it came out, and I saw, of course, Get Back, you know, so this is all Mike Lindsey Hogg's footage, everything, you know, that he directed, and including Get Back, because Peter Jackson took what he had done and then presented it. Mm-hmm. And then he remastered with Michael Let It Be Now. And if having seen Let It Be when it came out, in 1970, then seeing Get Back the last couple of years, and then seeing Let It Be Now, it was very heart-wrenching. It's like a different movie, even though it's just remastered. It's the same movie, but it really strikes a chord. And we can't have that movie right now. So hopefully we can have Michael Lindsay Hogg.
Yeah.
At other movies. But it's really wonderful. And I would suggest, I mean, you can't go back and see Let It Be in 1970, but if you watch Get Back and then you watch Let It Be, you'll be very touched, I think. We were all surprised how moved we were by it. You know, we all got a little choked up. And Tiffany was already Beatles'd out. Oh. She got choked up too.
I did.
It's so moving. Watching Get Back, the stuff that really got me was not like, oh yeah, McCartney is like writing a masterful beloved Beatles song. It's like all the little moments, like John and Yoko dancing while George is just like fucking around and playing I'm in Mine. Yeah.
And I found myself going, wow, I guess back in the 60s, you knew how to dance like that. Like you had a ballroom dance, or you still know how to do that. You learned that from your mother or whatever, your aunts. And then, but they both knew how to dance like that. I was like, who was dancing like that when I grew up? We were doing the twist or whatever. The shing-a-ling.
I think there's something in that movie that it's the camaraderie of the structure of a band, you know?
And
for me, it made me a little like, you know, nostalgic for playing music with some musicians that I just adored. And
you
know, seeing George even up on the roof, the way that he moves and the way that he's looking at people, I was like, oh, he reminds me of my friend Josh, who I played music with. And just the whole language that you have with each other when you're playing in a band, and you can look at each other and go, okay, yeah, now we're doing this. And, you know, all of that to me was, it's captured so perfectly in that movie. Just the kind of relationship that you have in a band. The opposite of that being Dig.
Yes.
The other side of being a man.
Yes.
We are.
Look at the sweet rosy, Let It Be. And then you can look at Dig and see both sides.
Yes.
All aspects of being in a band.
Yeah. Sometimes you're in harmony and you're not, but you ladies are always in harmony. And we just really appreciate you talking to us about your projects, and you're coming back. You're going to pick another topic anytime. Kate and I are ready. So thank you so much.
We might be calling on you for the streamer.
Yeah. We're around.
I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more, by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. You can also reach me or interact with Watch with Jen anytime on Twitter, either at Film Intuition or our Watch with Jen account as well. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.